The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 made it a legal obligation of the officers of the law, and indeed of every citizen in the North, to aid in recapturing runaway slaves. In practice, it served to intensify the activities of both white and black abolitionists. A group of fugitive slaves who had escaped to Canada met in Cazenovia, New York, in 1850, and adopted the following letter to the American slaves.
Afflicted and beloved brothers, the meeting which sends you this letter is a meeting of runaway slaves. We thought it well that they who had once suffered, as you still suffer, that they who had once drank of that bitterest of all bitter cups, which you are still compelled to drink of, should come together for the purpose of making a communication to you. Numerous as are the escapes from slavery, they would be far more so were you not embarrassed by your misinterpretations of the rights of property. You hesitate to take even the dullest of your master's horses, whereas it is your duty to take the fleetest. Your consciences suggest doubts whether in quitting your bondage you are at liberty to put in your packs what you need of food and clothing, but were you better informed, you would not scruple to break your master's locks and take all their money. You are taught to respect the rights of property, but no such rights belong to the slaveholder. His right to property is but the robber right. Moreover, if your oppressors have rights of property, you, at least, are exempt from all obligation to respect them, for you are prisoners of war in an enemy's country, of a war, too, that is unrivaled for its injustice, cruelty, meanness, and therefore, by all the rules of war, you have the fullest liberty to plunder, burn, and kill, as you may have occasion to do to promote your escape.
Many in northern cities defied the Fugitive Slave Act in every possible way. Thomas Wentworth Higginson, the Boston abolitionist, described the rescue of a fugitive named Shadrach.
On the day of the arraignment of the alleged fugitive, the fact was noted in a newspaper by a colored man of great energy and character, employed by a firm in Boston and utterly unconnected with the abolitionists. He asked leave of absence and strolled into the courthouse. Many colored men were at the door and had been excluded, but he, being known and trusted, was admitted, and the others, making a rush, followed in behind him with a hubbub of joking and laughter. There were but a few constables on duty, and it suddenly struck this leader, as he and his followers passed near the man under arrest, that they might as well keep on and pass out at the opposite door, taking among them the man under arrest, who was not handcuffed. After a moment's beckoning, the prisoner saw his opportunity, fell in with the jubilant procession, and amid continued uproar was got outside the courthouse when the crowd scattered in all directions. It was an exploit which was treated at Washington as if it had shaken the nation.
Those who participated in the rescue of fugitive slaves were themselves in danger of being tried for their actions. Charles Langston, a free Negro arrested in Oberlin, Ohio, for attempting to free a fugitive slave from United States Marshals in 1859, thus addressed the court after being declared guilty.
I was tried by a jury who were prejudiced, before a court that was prejudiced, prosecuted by an officer who was prejudiced. There is not a spot in the wide country, not even by the altars of God, no, nor in the old Philadelphia Hall, where any colored man may dare to ask mercy of a white man. Let me stand in that hall and tell a United States Marshal that my father was a revolutionary soldier, that he served under Lafayette and fought through the whole war, and that he fought for my freedom as much as for his own. And he would sneer at me and clutch me with his bloody fingers and say he has a right to make me a slave. Some say that there is no danger of free persons being seized and carried off as slaves. No one need labor under such a delusion. Sir, four of the eight persons who were first carried back under the Act of 1850 were afterwards proved to be free men.
Free Negroes lived in constant fear of being kidnapped and sold into slavery in the South. Defense organizations were formed among the Negroes. William Wells Brown described how his group managed to foil an attempted kidnapping in New York State.
We traveled on at a rapid rate until we met a man who made signs for us to stop. He informed us that the carriage we were in pursuit of was at the public house. We proceeded to the tavern where we found the carriage standing in front of the door with a pair of fresh horses ready to proceed on their journey. One of our company demanded the opening of the door while others surrounded the house. The kidnappers refused to let us enter the room, and the tavern keeper, who was more favorable to us than we had anticipated, said to us, "Boys, get into the room in any way that you can. The house is mine, and I give you the liberty to break in through the door or window." This was all that we wanted, and we were soon making preparations to enter the room at all hazards. As soon as they saw that we were determined to rescue the slaves, they gave up, one of their number telling us that we might come in. The door was thrown open, and we entered, and there found Stanford seated in one corner of the room, with his hands tied behind him, and his clothing, what little he had on, much stained with blood. Near him was his wife with her child, but a few weeks old, in her arms. Neither of them had anything on except their night clothes. They had been gagged to keep from alarming the people, and had been much beaten and bruised when first attacked by the kidnappers. Their countenances lighted up the moment we entered the room.
In 1847, Frederick Douglass, escaped slave, outstanding abolitionist, and crusader for human rights, published his own paper, The North Star, together with Martin R. Delaney in Rochester, New York. Their first editorial asserted,
"We solemnly dedicate the North Star to the cause of our long oppressed and plundered fellow countrymen. May God bless the undertaking to your good. Giving no quarter to slavery at the South, it will hold no truce with oppressors at the North. While it shall boldly advocate emancipation for our enslaved brethren, it will omit no opportunity to gain for the nominally free complete enfranchisement. Every effort to injure or degrade you or your cause, originating wheresoever or with whomsoever, shall find in it a constant, unswerving, and inflexible foe. Remember that we are one, that our cause is one, and that we must help each other if we would succeed. We have drank to the dregs the bitter cup of slavery. We have worn the heavy yoke. We have sighed beneath our bonds and writhed beneath the bloody lash. What you suffer, we suffer. What you endure, we endure. We are indissolubly united and must fall or flourish together."
Douglass was asked by the citizens of Rochester, New York, to deliver the principal address at the 4th of July celebration in 1852. In that speech, he said,
"What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty, an unholy license, your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation of the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour."
Although most Negroes continued to oppose any thought of emigration, a minority did support the idea, and in 1854, a Negro emigration convention was held in Pittsburgh. H. Ford Douglass, not related to Frederick Douglass, said to the convention,
"Is not the history of the world the history of emigration? The coming in and going out of nations is a natural and necessary result. Let us then be up and doing. To stand still is to stagnate and die. Shall we then refuse to follow the light which history teaches and be doomed, like our fathers, to perish in the dark wilderness of oppression? No. The expediency of a colored nationality is becoming self-evident to colored men more and more every day. When I remember that from Maine to Georgia, from the Atlantic waves to the Pacific shore, I am an alien and an outcast, unprotected by law, proscribed and persecuted by cruel prejudice, I am willing to forget the endearing name of home and country, and as an unwilling exile, seek on other shores the freedom which has been denied me in the land of my birth.
The decision of the Supreme Court in Dred Scott versus Sanford in 1857 reaffirmed the view of the slave as legal property and denied United States citizenship to the Negro. The reaction was a rising wave of indignation. A meeting in Philadelphia in 1857 resolved
that no allegiance is due from any man or any class of men to a government founded and administered in iniquity, and that the only duty the colored man owes to a constitution under which he is declared to be an inferior and degraded being, having no rights which white men are bound to respect, is to denounce and repudiate it, and to do what he can by all proper means to bring it into contempt.
Dr. John Rock of Massachusetts was an abolitionist, a physician, and a lawyer. The first Negro attorney admitted to practice before the United States Supreme Court. In a speech in 1858, he said,
"The prejudice which some white men have, or affected to have, against my color gives me no pain. If any man does not fancy my color, that is his business, and I shall not meddle with it. If he judges my intellectual capacity by my color, he certainly cannot expect much profundity, for it is only skin deep, and is really of no very great importance to anyone but myself. I will not deny that I admire the talents and noble characters of many white men, but I cannot say that I am particularly pleased with their physical appearance. When I contrast the fine, tough, muscular system, the beautiful, rich color, the full, broad features, and the gracefully frizzled hair of the Negro with the delicate physical organization, wan color, sharp features, and lank hair of the Caucasian, I am inclined to believe that when the white man was created, nature was pretty well exhausted. But determined to keep up appearances, she pinched up his features and did the best she could under the circumstances. I would have you understand that I not only love my race, but am pleased with my color. In this country, where money is the great sympathetic nerve which ramifies society and has a ganglia in every man's pocket, a man is respected in proportion to his success in business. When the avenues to wealth are opened to us, we will then become educated and wealthy. And then the roughest looking colored man that you ever saw or ever will see will be pleasanter than the harmonies of Orpheus, and black will be a very pretty color. It will make our jargon wit, our words oracles. Flattery will then take the place of slander, and you will find no prejudice in the Yankee whatever."
At a state convention of Massachusetts Negroes in 1858, a discussion of the possibility of a slave insurrection indicated strong differences of opinion among the delegates. A report of the proceedings appeared in the Liberator.
"Mr. Raymond moved that a committee of five be appointed to prepare an address suggesting to the slaves at the South to create an insurrection. He said he knew his resolution was in one sense revolutionary and in another treasonable, but so he meant it. He wanted to see the halfway fellows take themselves away and leave the field to men who would encourage their brethren at the South to rise with bowie knife and revolver and musket. Father Henson doubted whether the time had come for the people of Massachusetts to take any such step. If such a proposition were carried out, everything would be lost. Raymond might talk and then run away, but what would become of the poor fellows that must stand? And then the resolution was ridiculous for another reason. How could documents be circulated among the Negroes at the South? Catch the masters permitting that, and you catch a weasel asleep. However, they had nothing to fight with at the South, no weapons, no education. When I fight, said Father Henson, I want to whip somebody.
A year later, John Brown attempted to seize the arsenal at Harper's Ferry. His action helped crystallize differences over slavery and was a factor in precipitating the Civil War. In his last statement to the court, John Brown said,
I have, may it please the court, a few words to say. In the first place, I deny everything but what I have all along admitted. The design on my part to free the slaves, that was all I intended. I never did intend murder or treason or the destruction of property or to excite or incite slaves to rebellion or to make insurrection. I have another objection, and that is, it is unjust that I should suffer such a penalty. Had I interfered in the manner which I admit, had I so interfered in behalf of the rich, the powerful, the intelligent, the so-called great, or in behalf of any of their friends, and suffered and sacrificed what I have in this interference, it would have been all right, and every man in this court would have deemed it an act worthy of reward rather than punishment. This court acknowledges, as I suppose, the validity of the law of God. I see a book kissed here, which I suppose to be the Bible, or at least the New Testament. That teaches me that all things whatsoever I would that man should do to me, I should do even so to them. It teaches me further to remember them that are in bonds as bound with them. I endeavored to act up to that instruction. I say, I am yet too young to understand that God is any respecter of persons. I believe that to have interfered as I have done, as I have always freely admitted I have done, in behalf of his despised poor was not wrong, but right. Now, if it is deemed necessary that I should forfeit my life for the furtherance of the ends of justice and mingle my blood further with the blood of my children and with the blood of millions in this slave country whose rights are disregarded by wicked, cruel and unjust enactments, I submit, so let it be done.
Five of John Brown's band were Negroes. One of them, John Copeland, wrote this letter to his brother shortly before his execution. I'm not terrified by the gallows which I see stand me in the face, and upon which I'm soon to stand and suffer death for doing what George Washington was made a hero for doing. While for having lent my aid to a general no less brave and engaged in a cause no less honorable and glorious, I'm to suffer death. Now, Washington entered the field to fight for the freedom of the American people, not for the white man alone, but for both black and white. The blood of black men flowed as freely as that of white. It was a sense of the wrongs which we have suffered that prompted that noble but unfortunate Captain Brown and his associates to attempt to give freedom to a small number, at least, of those who are now held by cruel and unjust laws, and by no less cruel and unjust men. When the Civil War broke out, the Negroes were eager to add their strength to the forces of the North. Although their offers of enlistment were at first refused, they continued to press for participation in the struggle. The strong feelings of the Negroes are manifest in the resolutions of a mass meeting in Boston in May 1861.
Whereas the traitors of the South have assailed the United States government, with the intention of overthrowing it for the purpose of perpetrating slavery. And whereas, in such a contest between the North and South, believing as we do that it is a contest between liberty and despotism, it is as important for each class of citizens to declare as it is for the rulers of the government to know their sentiments and position. Therefore, resolved that our feelings urge us to say to our countrymen that we are ready to stand by and defend the government as the equals of its white defenders, to do so with our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor for the sake of freedom and as good citizens. And we ask you to modify your laws that we may enlist, that full scope may be given to the patriotic feelings burning in the colored man's breast. And we pledge ourselves to raise an army in the country of 50,000 colored men.
Finally, in 1862, Negroes were permitted to enlist, and eventually over 200,000 black soldiers and sailors served the Union cause. After the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation, Negro leaders were even more eloquent in urging enlistment, as in this editorial by Frederick Douglass, entitled, Men of Color to Arms.
When first the rebel cannon shattered the walls of Sumter and drove away its starving garrison, I predicted that the war then and there inaugurated would not be fought out entirely by white men. Every month's experience during these weary years has confirmed that opinion. A war undertaken and brazenly carried on for the perpetual enslavement of colored men calls logically and loudly for colored men to help suppress it. Only a moderate share of sagacity was needed to see that the arm of the slave was the best defense against the arm of the slaveholder. Hence, with every reverse to the national arms, with every exulting shout of victory raised by the slave-holding rebels, I have implored the imperiled nation to unchain against her foes her powerful black hand. There is no time to delay. The tide is at its flood that leads on to fortune. From east to west, from north to south, the sky is written all over, now or never. Liberty won by white men would lose half its luster. Who would be free themselves must strike the blow. Better even die free than to live slaves. This is the sentiment of every brave colored man amongst us. The case is before you. This is our golden opportunity. Let us accept it and forever wipe out the dark reproaches unsparingly hurled against us by our enemies. Let us win for ourselves the gratitude of our country and the best blessings of our posterity through all time.